This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
Keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Hello, it's me, Gary Clinton, and I'm here once again with an episode of Night Transmissions. This particular one is the 104th. You know, of course, that the Black Museum, a program of crime dramas, is not a documentary. They act as if it is, as if the cases are factual, and they are. Well, they are sort of. Sometimes the stories they present stay pretty close to the facts. Other times they wander off a bit. This is the case with this episode from September the 30th of 1952. It is based on a real murder. Actually, an attempted murder and a real murder by one Herbert Armstrong, who was a solicitor and magistrate's clerk in Herefordshire, England, and as such, is the only solicitor in Britain to have ever been hanged for murder. In this episode, they call him Colonel John Reed. So that's the first thing they do, is they change the name. And don't really mention that he was a solicitor. In fact, they make him a real estate agent. The murder that he was first charged with is the murder of a professional rival by arsenic poisoning. They have that right in the show. Oh, they have him murder his wife in the show, too. And he did that. But it wouldn't be until later that he was charged with that. They have the police exhuming the body after discovering that he was attempting to poison that other fellow. Anyway, he had been a soldier, and he was definitely a poisoner, an aficionado of arsenic, and he was hung on the 31st of May, 1922, for murder.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
The Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a man's necktie, a woman's glove, a boy's school cap, all are touched by murder. Now, here's a champagne glass. That's a familiar object. Long stem, delicate curve, shining crystal. This fragile object belongs to New Year's Eve, to weddings, and the anniversaries.
Funny about things like this, Sergeant.
Funny, sir? I'd say that one was loaded.
I meant funny in a philosophical sense, Sergeant. Funny how human beings can take an article meant for happiness and use it for tragedy.
Now, anyway, that champagne glass can be found today in the Black Museum.
The annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Well, here we are in the Black Museum. Scotland Yard's museum of murder. This place echoes with violent death. Voices are hollow here, whether the hollowness is caused by the high-vaulted ceilings or by the reaction of the human mind to the atmosphere of this room.
The effect is the same. Everybody who comes here learns a sense of fear. It's natural, because here lies death. Death, cruel, unnecessary, vengeful, greedy. Still the kind of death brought by one man or one woman on another. This is a record to be studied not merely by criminologists, but by every student of man's inhumanity to man. Here's an iron skillet. It's heavy in your hand, the kind of kitchen utensil your grandmother used. Well balanced, quite suitable for frying eggs or veal chops, or for bashing a skull, perhaps. There's little doubt as to the use which brought this particular skillet here. Yes? And here's the champagne glass. It's well designed, graceful. You could place it with a companion on a silver tray, as Colonel Harry Reed did. Could pop a cork and then fill the glasses, as Colonel Harry Reed did. And you might say, as the dapper colonel did,
to you, my dear Elizabeth, to your return and your complete recovery.
I wish I could drink to that wholeheartedly, Harry. Really, I do.
Well, why not, my dear? You've been released, you're there.
That's it, exactly. I've been released. Not merely sent home from a hospital, so to speak. After all, the hospital I was in had bars on the windows.
Oh, I insist, my dear, that you touch glasses with me and drink at once. That's no way to talk.
But, Harry, I...
Ah, there are no buts, Elizabeth. Many people have had nerve breakdowns, and the vast majority of them have recovered.
Very well, Harry, dear. But not to me, to you, the most patient of husbands in the world.
So they drank the champagne, and all was well. It's very pleasant, very relaxing, reassuring. But the world is always too much with us, and the colonel finally had to say,
"Now you rest until dinner, Elizabeth. Have a beef up on my... I won't be long."
And the colonel kissed his wife, and the colonel went off to his appointment.
It's 6 months now, Reed. One way or the other, the matter ought to be settled.
I assure you, Davis, there's nothing to worry about. These things take time.
There's been plenty of time. Look, Reed, if you don't want to complete the deal, return the £500.
But it's not up to me. My client...
Your client indicated you willingly disposed of the property. My client paid the deposit in good faith. We considered a binder on the contract. We waited 6 months.
Your £500 is quite safe, Davis. You can reassure your client. And on my side, we'll go through with the deal as soon as everything is clear.
Well, I certainly hope so. My people want to take possession.
And they shall. They shall indeed. And soon. Meanwhile, there's no reason for misunderstanding between us, is there? After all, we live in the same small town. We see each other constantly. You know, John, I've often wondered why we don't see more of each other. Socially, that is.
Rather a changeable fellow, the colonel, isn't he? There were other changes ahead. More serious ones. They first came to somewhat public notice the night our colonel called Dr. Ashley to his home.
Ah, Dr. Ashley. Good of you to come so quickly.
You made it sound rather urgent, Colonel. Is it really serious?
Yes, I'm afraid, Doctor. Really afraid. It's my wife.
Has she broken down again?
No. She complains of terrible pain in her abdomen.
I'd better see her at once.
Yeah, this way, please. If you can, Doctor.
Yes?
She seems to me to be as much frightened as she is in pain.
Oh? What exactly do you mean by that?
Frightened that, that her pain is in her imagination.
I see. Oh, very well. Bear that in mind, Colonel.
In here.
If you'll wait outside, Colonel, please.
Oh, must I, Doctor?
I prefer it.
Very well.
Now then, Mrs. Reed. Can you hear me, Mrs. Reed?
The good colonel waited outside the door. Up and down, back and forth, he paced, almost as if he were once again on guard duty. Grim-faced, tense, he waited. At long last.
You better come in, Colonel. Quick.
Doctor, is she...
I'm afraid so. I've done everything I can.
Moments later, Elizabeth Reed was at rest. At last. Tears streamed down the colonel's cheeks. But he was silent. There seemed nothing to say.
The doctor led him away and told him gently.
It was acute gastritis. And her heart. You want the minister, I assume, and the mortician. I'll send the certificate over. Natural causes.
Attended funeral. The flowers were piled high in tribute to the colonel's position in the town as well as to the memory of his wife. And then the colonel resumed his life, somewhat more lonely but still active, bearing himself in military fashion as he went about his small real estate business, and time drifted by. 1 month, two, and then one day on the main street.
Good morning, Colonel.
Ah, Davis, good to see you.
I've hesitated discussing this, your recent bereavement and so on, but don't you think we need to close our deal, Reed?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. I'm rather by myself these days. Would you care to join me for tea or get something stronger one afternoon?
You say when, Reed. I'll be glad to.
Excellent. Then, shall we say tomorrow? Five-ish?
Why not? Your place or mine?
Well, mine, of course. Delighted to have you. That was Connor, man. Really excellent. My housekeeper has quite the touch.
Thank you. I will.
Almost as if we were a pair of elderly ladies. Tea and scones.
Two gentlemen, somewhat past middle age, enjoying tea and scones and making ready to discuss business. In fact, they did discuss business. The £500 deposit and the pending deal. And John Davis went home quite satisfied. John Davis went home and a little later called Dr. Ashley.
Understand it, Doctor. My stomach's like cast iron. Always has been. Now, suddenly, this.
None of us are quite as young as we used to be. Even cast iron can wear thin with use. Eaten anything out of the ordinary, John? Today? Yesterday?
No, nothing. Had some scones for tea. The butter may have been a bit rancid, but tasted perfectly fresh. Over Colonel Reed's.
Eh? Reed's?
Yes, that's why. We had a little business to discuss. He asked me over. Seems quite lonely since his wife passed on, so I went, mostly to keep him company.
Oh, nice of you. Well, just take the prescription I'm leaving you. Rest a day or two. You'll be all right.
What's wrong, Doctor?
Oh, nothing. Just a quirk of memory.
Oh? How so?
Your symptoms and Mrs. Reed's rather the same. Nothing serious about it, just odd. That we should have two similar cases in such close juxtaposition. A town like this, a doctor gets to know most of the illness.
As the doctor said, nothing serious. Just an interesting coincidence. And in a day or so, John Davis was up and about. Aside from a slight tenderness in his abdomen, he felt no after effects. All was well. All was quiet. Everyone was his courteous self, including Colonel Reed.
Well, now, candy. And from the Colonel. How decent of him. Here it is, Doctor. The same wrappings it came in.
Nice looking box. Don't you care for candy, John? You haven't eaten much.
As a matter of fact, I don't. I did offer a piece to the charwoman at the office. You see, one's missing.
The charwoman, eh? Is that the way you treat a gift? With the hope you are sufficiently recovered to enjoy this, Harry Reed. Rather decent of him.
That's what I thought, until the charwoman was taken with pains and reaching an hour after she ate the candy.
Are you suggesting anything, John?
That would be slanderous at this stage, wouldn't it?
There's nothing to it, John. There couldn't be. The Colonel...
Well, I inquired at the probate office. He did rather well following his wife's death and her will, you know. He never had any money of his own to speak of. Former military men rarely do.
Yes, it might be interesting. I've done practically no laboratory work of my own for some time. But I have a little equipment. Shall I try my hand at a bit of chemical analysis, John? I'm curious about the contents of that box of candy. You seem to be as well as I.
The doctor was methodical, to say the least. He took his time setting up his equipment, preparing reagents, making ready for his private little tests. Meanwhile, John Davis ran into his friend, the Colonel, on the street.
John, good to see you.
How are you, Harry? You're looking fit.
Well, I try to keep that way. Well, care to join me for another attack of indigestion, Omen?
Well, today, the champagne glass we've been talking about can be seen, as you might expect, among the other exhibits. Black Museum. The Colonel and John Davis parted quite amicably on the street. Davis watched the smart military walk the ramrod straight back as the Colonel paraded into his own office under his head. Somehow it didn't seem quite plausible that this man might be something quite different than what he seemed. The next afternoon, the telephone rang in John Davis's office.
Yes?
Oh, that you, John? This is Harry here.
Harry? Oh, yes, of course. How are you?
Very well. And you?
Quite well.
No more summer cake?
No trace.
Well, and how about this evening?
Sorry, old man, I can't this evening. But perhaps in a day or so.
Oh, too bad. Oh, I'll be speaking to you. Goodbye.
Bye.
That evening, Davis had a previous appointment with Dr. Ashley in his makeshift laboratory.
This little operation here is the Marsh test.
Oh?
For arsenic.
Interesting.
Yes, isn't it? Particularly since I found that every piece of candy in your gift box had arsenic in it.
Good Lord!
Arsenic, you see, is a cumulative poison. Personally, I have a tolerance for quite a large amount of it. But it usually fails to pass through the human system. It accumulates, and bit by bit, the fatal dose is built up until one day the victim dies. Dr. Ashley explained all this to John Davis. Finally, John grasped the significance of the facts.
Each piece of candy would never bother the ordinary stomach or the cast iron type, such as you both did you have. Most people could eat a piece or two, indeed. You had eaten most of the candy yourself. Well, you follow me, I gather?
Follow you? Doctor, I'm a step ahead of you. But exactly what that step is, I'm not sure. I think we need expert help.
The local constabulary?
I said expert help.
Where from?
The CID, Scotland Yard.
It was a clear, cogent letter reciting the situation as Dr. Ashley and John Davis knew it. It was addressed to the Home Secretary, the gentleman in the British government responsible for the police force in general. In due course, the letter reached the desk of Inspector Charles in Scotland Yard. Following the set routine, Inspector Charles showed the communication to his immediate assistant, Detective Sergeant Hatch.
Well, nothing else for it. You and I will have to take a small trip to the country. Frankly, I won't mind. I can use a touch of country air after all.
They came into the quiet town unobtrusively. Two men on a walking tour, vacationists. They put up at the inn. Toward sundown, they strolled about the town. Quite casually. They turned in at the gate with its little sign announcing that Dr. Ashley had his dispensary there. Once, however, within the doctor's office.
Now then, Doctor, perhaps you'd let Sergeant Hatch and I have it from the beginning.
Well, my entrance into the situation came shortly after Mrs. Reed returned from the sanitarium.
She'd been ill?
Mentally ill.
Nervous breakdown?
Rather more than that. She'd been certified insane. She was discharged as being quite stable once again.
And you were called in?
In my professional capacity. I found her past help. Acute gastritis, or so it seemed at the time.
But it doesn't seem so now?
You understand, Inspector, I have no facts. At least not on that side. I merely analyzed the box of candy received by John Davis shortly after he'd been taken ill.
Doctor, would this Colonel Reed benefit from Mr. Davis's death?
There'd been something about a real estate and a deposit paid. Quite a large sum, I believe. Mr. Davis can give you the details.
One final question, sir. Who had Mrs. Reed committed to the institution in the first instance?
Why, I believe the husband did. But the records will be available to you, of course.
Of course. Oh, thank you, Doctor. If we need you...
By the time they left the doctor's office, Inspector Charles and Sergeant Hatch felt they had heard an interesting, if circumstantial, story. Their next stop, naturally, was John Davis's home.
You've no idea, gentlemen, what a relief it is to have police officers of your caliber on the job.
Thank you. About the candy and the card in the box, do you have any definite reason to believe the Colonel wants you, well, out of the way?
There's the matter of £500 he either will not or cannot explain.
And Dr. Ashley mentioned Mrs. Reed's will.
Yes, curious about that.
There was one will made out entirely in favor of her children by her first marriage. The will which was accepted and executed was in the Colonel's handwriting, but signed by Mrs. Reed and produced subsequent to her death.
You find that interesting, I take it, Sergeant?
I expect you do as well, sir.
Quite. Mr. Davis, do you think it might be possible to exhume Mrs. Reed's body without the matter becoming common knowledge in the whole town?
The men from Scotland Yard accomplished the almost impossible. Armed with the proper papers, plus tools and dark lanterns, they supervised the removal of the body at night, with no one the wiser except the necessary officials. This feat completed, they waited quite patiently. A government analyst was called in. The report was brief. Inspector Charles read it to Dr. Ashley.
Examination reveals the presence of 4 grains of arsenic, more than a fatal dose, and the largest amount of the poison I have ever found in human remains. Well, that's it, Doctor.
And I didn't recognize the symptoms. Acute gastritis, I call it.
Why should you have recognized them, sir? I dare say murder of any kind is hardly a common occurrence in your practice. Well, Sergeant, since our warrant is all in order, it begins to appear that a search of Colonel Reed's premises may be next on the agenda.
Now the pretense of the walking tour was completely discarded. It was Saturday, and the sleepy little village was just about bestirring itself. The inspector and the sergeant walked a short distance from the inn to Colonel Reed's place of business, almost directly opposite Davis's office. The sergeant tried the door.
Not locked, sir.
A locked door in these parts would arouse more suspicion than not. Let's go in, shall we?
One file cabinet, one desk, telephone, chair for visitors. Can't do much of a business.
I dare say not. Let's get to it.
The search was quite thorough. The desk was emptied of its contents. These were replaced in an orderly fashion.
Oh, nothing extraordinary here, sir. Well, what do you make of this, sir?
Champagne glass. The rear of the file cabinet. It's odd.
Shall I hold it aside, sir?
Yes, you may as well. Interesting, the trace of sediment. Apparently, it was never washed after it was used the last time. Anything else in there, Sergeant?
Well, what's going on in here?
Colonel Reed?
Yes. More to the point, for you to identify yourselves and your business here, if any.
Inspector Charles, CID. My identity card. This is Sergeant Hatch.
I see. I assume you have a warrant for this search.
We do. Right here, Colonel.
Very well. Go on with your work.
May I ask why you were keeping the champagne glass in the file cabinet?
A memento to my poor wife. We drank from it. Oh, that is, she did, about a week before she passed away.
A nice gesture, if I may say so. And still with a trace of the sediment at the bottom. Careful, sir. It'd be a pity to have the glass break after all this time.
Oh, sorry. Awkward of me to brush against it like that.
Yes, wasn't it? All right, Sergeant, you can open the desk drawer the Colonel just closed and see what he put in it.
But you said you'd fill it.
Your pardon, Colonel.
I've had quite enough of this.
These paper packets weren't in here a few minutes ago, Inspector.
How many?
Look here, I wouldn't have
20 of them, sir.
I'll take one. Thank you. White powder.
Well?
This wouldn't be arsenic, would it, Colonel?
It not only would be, it is.
Really?
Well, as you can see, I'm wearing my gardening coat. Ordinarily, I do not come into the office on Saturday, but something came up. I've been planning an experiment in my garden, hence the arsenic.
A garden, an experiment? With 20 packets of arsenic?
Yes. My lawn is plagued with dandelions, roughly 2 dozen of them. I plan to drill a small hole at the root of each weed, pour in the arsenic in each of those packets, and kill each dandelion individually, rather than take the chance of ruining the whole lawn.
Sorry, Colonel, it's a good story, but rather far-fetched. Particularly since you tried to rid yourself of the packets before we searched your person. And particularly since the charge pending is willful murder of your wife by arsenical poisoning.
But this is ridiculous. Someone is
trying. Keep that champagne glass safe before Colonel Reed succeeds in smashing it.
Yes, sir.
Colonel Reed, you are under arrest. The charge is murder. I must warn you that anything you may say...
I will not stand.
Hold it, Sergeant. I'll be acquitted. You'll see, and then I'll have to leave here. A trial?
That will make it right enough, Colonel. You've made several mistakes, not the least of which was your attempt on John Davis, and your preservation of this glass. A sentimental gesture, but rather silly. My bet is the sediment in it will turn out to be arsenic. You must have been very sure of yourself, Colonel, to leave this glass unwashed. Very sure of yourself, indeed. Bring him along, Sergeant. I think he'll come quietly now.
And today, that champagne glass can be seen in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
There was no doubt about one facet of Colonel Reed's character. He was a man of great pride. His behavior at the trial was exemplary. His bearing, military. He repeated his story of the separate packets of arsenic for separate dandelions, and he sounded as if he'd made a good case of it. At least for himself. Well, not, as it turned out, for the jury. Colonel Reed accepted his sentence as if it were an order from a superior officer. And one morning, at the traditional time of 8 o'clock, Colonel Reed marched to the scaffold as if he were on parade. And as for the champagne glass, well, it remains in its customary place, as I told you, in Scotland Yard. Now, until we meet next time, in the same place, and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Strange Adventure. The night was cold and dark. The stars flickered in the winter sky like millions of shivering lights. Ralph Hagstrom felt utterly alone as he skimmed across the lake, his blades cutting a knife-like trail in the ice. He would be glad to reach the little village to attend the wedding of Paul Boudreau and Marie Levesque. Marie. He thought of her dancing eyes and bewitching smile. He had loved Marie, loved her madly. Now she was to become the bride of his best friend. He was to be the best man. He glanced at the luminous dial on his watch. 10 o'clock. It came to him like a shock that he was not alone. His eyelashes were frosted and his eyes blurred with the cold. A trick of nature, he thought. He rubbed his eyes and looked again. Yes, there it was, far in front of him, the figure of a skater in long white garments that fluttered ghost-like in the clear night. The phantom skater glided over the ice with the speed and grace that matched his very own, ever staying the same distance ahead. He called aloud, but there was no answer. He saw the figure ahead lift an arm, beckoning him to follow. He wondered who this stranger must be and determined to find out. He followed, thinking to catch his wraith-like companion. But however fast he might go, the white skater went faster. His strange companion seemed to draw him irresistibly, and so he followed through the night. When dawn came, she was gone, and the young man found himself at his destination. He removed his skates and followed the path that ran along the shore of the lake. As the sun rose above the wooded hills, he chanced to gaze lakeward. He was awe-stricken at the sight that met his eyes. There was a great wind drift in the ice. Had he swept along his intended path, watching the stars to guide him, he would have skated into this danger area. His speed and weight would have sent him crashing through the broken ice to a chilling death below. He remembered the white skater. The phantom figure had been his guardian angel. Ralph hurried to the home of his friend. Paul Boudreau opened the door. Ralph sensed there was something wrong.
What's the matter, Paul? This is your wedding day.
No wedding.
What do you mean?
Marie died last night.
Ralph was stunned. Some accident or some strange malady must have struck her down. He inquired of his friend.
Paul was sad as he spoke. Yesterday afternoon, Marie went skating on the ice. She came home chilled and wandering in her mind. She fell ill and became delirious. She talked of you, Ralph.
Of me? I don't understand.
Neither did we.
She said you were on the ice, that you were on your way here. She said you didn't know of the ice breaking up and begged me to meet you and warn you of the danger. She told me she loved you and you must be saved. She died as the clock was striking 10.
Ralph pondered, remembering. It was at 10 o'clock when he had noted the time and when he had first seen his phantom guide.
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye for my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
I wouldn't get carried away or anything, but this is our first break. I promise not to be too annoying or anything.
I love Bato. It's rich in chocolate tea. Chocolate flavored Bato is mighty good for me. Mama puts it in my milk for extra energy. Bato gives me iron and sunshine vitamin D. Oh, I love Bato. Let's drink for me.
Up next is a program called Darkness. I wish I could tell you more about it, but I can't. I don't know where it was made. I don't know who made it. I don't know who starred in it. Don't know who produced it, who wrote it. I know that it was made in 1979, and there were at least 8 episodes because that many survived. I liked it reasonably well. I hope you do. If you happen to know anything about this program, pretty much anything at all, I'd appreciate it if you'd drop me a note at nighttransmissions@gmail.com, or you can go by the website and drop a comment there. Website is, not surprisingly, nighttransmissions.com.
Into the future, I can see so many things. Even now, I'm getting vibrations from some of our listeners. Ah, here's one. A lady with the initial C. Oh, sorry, my dear. You're going to have a slight accident. Somebody's going to strangle you. Oh, I love
to... Stop being so stubborn. We can't let him stay in that house another week. He needs care. He should go into a residence.
You mean sanitarium?
I would hardly call a private suite in Las Villas a sanitarium.
It's all the same.
Frank and I can afford it. You don't have to contribute a dime.
It is not the money. It's the idea. You try, yes, you are, about putting that away.
You make me sound like an ogre.
He's lived in that house for 30 years. They lived there. We grew up there. Take him out of it? No, it would kill him.
But her memories are killing him. You think I want to hurt him?
No, of course not.
I don't want to see him destroyed by this fantasy. Oh, it's ripping me apart.
Annie, maybe we can figure out some of the solutions.
There isn't. He wouldn't agree to a companion or a housekeeper. He refuses to move in with us. Las Villas is the answer.
Eric, no. Has Frank gone off the papers? Has he?
Yes. You and I are named as joint conservators.
You've got no heart.
That was uncalled for. I want to get in the best treatment, the best psychiatrist.
Well, you finally admitted it is a sanitarium, a nut house.
It's a rest home. Ron, you know what we have to do?
Give me a couple of days. I want to sort this out. Annie, it's tearing me up also.
I understand. Every time he tells me he's fucking with Mom, or she's upstairs, I sigh.
Okay. Here, take it easy.
He told me this morning that they're driving to the summer house next weekend. What? We know that's impossible.
Of course we do. Mom's been dead for a year. Cummings!
coming. Rog, Annie. What a pleasant surprise.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, sport? Never better. Well, come in. Fantastic day, no? Can't wait to open a summer house.
You're really going?
Oh, absolutely. Your mother and I need a change. Frankly, it'll do her a world of good. And me, too.
Well, that's what we want to talk to you about.
Annie, are you all right? Something bothering you? Frank okay?
Yeah. Sit down.
Well, just for a moment. We want to beat the traffic.
Please, don't go.
What's impossible? I promised your mother. We're all packed.
Oh,
not. Oh, no, Annie. Annie, this isn't like you. I'm fine. I know what you're thinking, but your mother has come back.
Oh.
Now, be a brave girl.
Shh, Dad. Dad, it can't be. It's impossible.
You're wrong.
Look, we've discussed this with...
I know. Your mother told me all about the meeting with Dr. Morgan and Las Villas.
You know?
Certainly. Catherine and I discussed it at length.
Mm.
Oh, but we have. Your mother and I are very happy right here. I am not going into one of those homes.
You heard us talking about Las Villas?
No. Catherine told me.
You can't go on like this. You'll destroy yourself.
Oh, rubbish. I never felt better in my life. Your mother and I are just as happy as before. Now, come on, you two screwed. We've got a full packing to finish.
I don't want you to leave.
You're a good son. You mean well. Do me a favor. Trust me.
Dad.
I want both of you to trust me. Please.
Okay. Will you call us when you get back?
Without fail. Now, everybody out.
I love you.
And we love you too, baby. Speak with you tonight.
Kathy? Are you ready?
Not yet.
Always like a woman.
What are you grumbling about?
The time it takes you to put on a new face.
That's the price you pay for not marrying a beauty.
I told the children.
I heard. They're serious, you know.
Suppose so.
Las Villas won't be like home.
You could stop them. It's in your power.
Oh, I wish I could, but it's against the rules.
Make another request. Say it's a special case.
I have, dear, but they won't make any exceptions.
If you could appear to the children just once, let them see you as I do, we could put an end to this whole matter.
You know I can't do that.
They'll try to have me committed, won't they?
I couldn't bear to see you in one of those places.
At least we'll be together.
I won't be allowed to go.
What?
It's another rule.
You mean if they put me in one of those places, you...
It's their way of catching you.
That's unfair. Can't they see we're happy? You've got to tell them.
My darling, they know. They want us to be together. They always want the selected ones to be with each other.
We are. Why change everything?
Simon, I was advised that I've only 3 days left.
3 days? But you said it was indefinite.
That was before this business with the residence hall.
This is a nightmare.
But we can always be together.
I can't lose you again.
You don't have to. It would be so simple. Sweetheart, it's painless.
There has to be a different way.
There isn't.
I don't know if I can.
Oh, even for me? For us?
How do I know? How?
That your mind is playing tricks? That I'm not a fantasy?
Yes. Yes.
That's the challenge. The ultimate test of your love.
You know I love you. They know I love you.
Do you, Simon? Do I have your undying love?
Haven't I proved myself?
Not to their satisfaction.
Must I prove it that way?
Yes, you must.
Come in.
Roger.
Ann, glad to see you.
Dr. Morgan.
Good afternoon.
Sit down. Make yourself comfortable. Have you come to any decision?
Not really. I still think Las Villas would be ideal.
There has to be an alternative.
Of course, there is psychiatry.
You know what he said to that.
My hands are tied. If your dad refuses treatment, how can I help him?
Suppose he's declared incompetent.
He's not.
Face it, Roger, he is.
I will never sign any commitment papers.
I don't want him walking around hallucinating.
He's harmless.
Today, yes. But tomorrow, the next day? Suppose he gets it into his head to join her.
Oh, ridiculous.
Is it? Talking to a dead woman, seeing her, dining with her, is it?
Then let him stay at home. Leave him alone.
Please. Arguing won't solve this. Let me visit him. Talk with him. Depending on the outcome of that, well, we can make a decision.
Oh, all right. That seems fair.
Fine. He'll return from the summer house tonight.
Shall we say tomorrow at 10?
Something about that cottage.
Memories.
Or it's serenity. We've spent some of our happiest moments there.
Yes, darling, I know. Simon, they're going to have a doctor examine you tomorrow.
Oh?
I won't be able to help you.
I understand.
I only have another day.
I realize that.
Oh, let's go back to the summer house. You can do it there.
No, it's too filled with wonderful memories.
I don't want to lose you.
Please, Captain, please.
You must make a choice. Be with me. Forever. Oh, please, sweetheart. If you love me, Simon, commit suicide. And we'll never be separated again.
Sanitarium. Is Catherine real, or is he hearing voices? We'll resolve his dilemma in a moment. Or will we?
For those who just tuned in, you're listening to Dark. It's a new drama series airing every Wednesday at 5:30 on KCSN. We invite those who aren't faint of heart and those who are not afraid of bumps in the night to join us on 88.5 KCSN Northridge.
And now the final act of Trust Me, Darling, I Love You.
Just called to tell you that we're back.
Hey, great. Enjoy yourself?
You got some time for your old man?
Anything the matter?
Suppose I meet you in your office. Half hour, all right?
Sure. Half hour's fine.
Catherine, your mother wants me to join her.
Dad, this is going too far. Look, you're imagining this. It's a form of grieving. Dr. Morgan explained everything to Anne and I.
But I talked with her. We do things together. She even prepared me. Rod, she's real.
Yes, to you she is.
She is real.
Why don't we see her?
It's not permitted.
Now, she wants you to join her to commit suicide.
Is that what you want?
Yes!
No.
Then you doubt this apparition.
Yes, but I'm not sure. I'm confused. Sometimes I...
Dad. We'd like you to consider going into a residency.
Never!
They're just for some tests. Talk with them. Look, it'll only take a few days. Please.
I can't.
I have to choose tonight. They want it that way.
They? Dad, it's in your mind. It's not real.
How can you be so sure?
You don't know.
I don't want ever to lose her. I can't live without her. I can't. No, thank you, dear.
Did he resolve anything with Roger?
No, he wants them to examine me.
Oh, Kevin, reveal yourself just once. Prove to the children that I'm not crazy.
Oh, Simon, I thought you really, really believed.
I do.
Then come with me. Hey, Anne, in an instant, we'll spend eternity together.
I can't. I'm afraid. Afraid that you're an illusion. And I'm sane.
Oh, my God. I've come back. I want to take you with me.
I need more time. A week. A week.
Impossible. We have only another evening.
And then?
I leave. And we'll be parted forever.
Sit down.
Why are you stalling? You want him to commit suicide?
Shut up. Stop it, the two of you.
I am not going to let him do it.
He may not. He's not sure.
The fantasy is driving him mad. Ron, I want him committed.
And I don't want him locked up. Nothing will be settled by fighting.
Just suppose
that she's real.
Don't be stupid.
We may be denying him a life with her.
Ron, if we don't act, he'll kill himself.
And if this phenomenon is from the other side, it isn't. It's a product of severe emotional stress. Wishful thinking becomes reality. Illusion blends into truth. Compulsion to be with her. I've seen many cases like this.
Oh, you're so damn sure of yourself, aren't you?
Roger, please, I'm scared.
Why don't we take an intermediate step just to get over this crisis? Let's have your father admitted on a temporary basis.
Right.
Okay. Drop the papers.
Simon?
Yes, sir?
They're coming for you. The children want to put you under observation.
Roger would never agree.
He has. And also.
Stop them. We've got to stop them.
I can't. Simon, trust me. It's like going to sleep. When you pass through, you'll be at one.
Give me time. I need more time.
He's almost done. Listen. Please, now. Do it now. Later, I might be with someone else. Don't you want to be with me, Simon?
Of course, but I'm afraid. Afraid?
Don't let him go with another.
How long do we have?
An hour or eternity. The choice is yours, Simon.
Dad, go away.
Please, we want to talk with you.
I know why you're here. You're not committing me to an asylum.
It isn't. We don't want to lose you.
You've created this.
No. Mother did.
Daddy? Please.
Right.
It'll be fine. Just fine.
She can't do this. Mother and I won't let you. We need you.
That's all. Come on with me. Stay with us.
Frank and I would love to have you. We'll take a trip. Yes, we're all going on vacation.
Everybody. The kids, the dogs. Like old times. Even him. Is he waiting for me?
We didn't know what to do. Dr. Morgan, we can handle this.
Perhaps. Dr. Roy, please, let us speak to him alone.
I'll be in the car if you need me.
You really were going to have me committed.
Just for test.
You were afraid that you might... Well, that's over now. He isn't.
My own children. How could you?
Well, we didn't want you to do anything rash.
You mean irrational? You didn't trust me. You thought I was mad. A raving lunatic.
No.
You think your mother is a hallucination. A vision of a madman, yes?
No. It's just...
Just what? We don't know.
Simon, it's almost time.
All of you. Pressing. Badgering me. She wants me. You want...
We have such a little time left.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joy Chan. English fairy tales collected by Joseph Jacobs. He was once a man who travelled the land all over in search of a wife. He saw young and old, rich and poor, pretty and plain, and could not meet with one to his mind. At last he found a woman, young, fair, and rich, who possessed a right arm of solid gold. He married her at once, and thought no man so fortunate as he was. They lived happily together, but, though he wished people to think otherwise, he was fonder of the golden arm than of all his wife's gifts besides. At last she died. The husband put on the blackest black, and pulled the longest face at the funeral. but for all that he got up in the middle of the night, dug up the body, and cut off the golden arm. He hurried home to hide his treasure and thought no one would know. The following night, he put the golden arm under his pillow and was just falling asleep when the ghost of his dead wife glided into the room. Stalking up to the bedside, it drew the curtain and looked at him reproachfully. Pretending not to be afraid, he spoke to the ghost and said, "What hast thou done with thy cheeks so red?" "All withered and wasted away," replied the ghost in a hollow tone. "What hast thou done with thy red rosy lips?" "All withered and wasted away." "What hast thou done with thy golden hair?" "All withered and wasted away." "What hast thou done with thy golden arm?" "Thou hast it." End of the Golden Arm.
Another 5-minute mystery. An anniversary party is going on at the Brown household around the corner. One of the guests, George Taylor, pauses while eating his dessert to say,
best lemon chiffon pie I've ever tasted, Mary.
Oh, really?
I wish my wife could do as well.
Oh, thank you.
Say, it doesn't look as if Sam is appreciating it much, though.
Goodness, dear, is my cooking that bad? Sam, your head's practically in your plate. I guess it's fallen asleep every night, and I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
Sam, sit up. Oh, this is dreadful. I'd better shake him. Sam! Sam!
Great God, he's dead.
How do you do? I'm Sergeant Barker, the Homicide Division.
Oh.
He's one of my boys, Mike Grady. Where's the body?
In the dining room at the table. We didn't move him.
I might as well be comfortable, everybody. This'll take just a little while.
Dead all right. Peaceful, too.
Who's Mrs. Sam Brown?
I am.
And do you mind telling me what happened?
I guess not. I'm so shocked, I don't know where to begin or what to tell you.
Well, you might as well begin by telling me what you served for dinner.
Well, we had soup first.
Soup? What kind?
Mushroom, then roast chicken, green peas, mashed potatoes, dessert, and coffee. But I don't see how this could mean anything.
Yeah, just routine, Mrs. Brown. Did Mr. Brown eat everything?
Yes, he did. He seemed to fall asleep over his coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And when I tried to wake him, I found he'd had a heart attack.
Yeah. That'll be all for a few minutes, Mrs. Brown. We want to take a look around. Notice anything about this table, Mike?
No, Chief, I can't say as I do.
Yeah, neither do I. Let's look in this kitchen here. Yeah, orderly person, isn't she? Stacked the dishes after each course.
Yes, and here's the silverware over here. Ah, look, Chief. One of these soup spoons has turned black.
Right? Let me see it. And the only spoon that's tarnished, too. Well, I was beginning to think it was a heart attack or a perfect murder, but this silver soup spoon is evidence enough. Mrs. Brown.
Yes, Sergeant Barker.
I'm sorry to interrupt your little party, Mrs. Brown, but I'm sure your guests won't mind.
I don't understand.
You will, Mrs. Brown, you will. You see, you're under arrest for the murder of your husband.
Do you know why Sergeant Barker accused Mrs. Brown of murder? In a moment, we'll hear the solution.
Autolite resistor spark plugs are ignition engineered by Autolite, which makes more than 400 products for cars, trucks, airplanes, and boats in 28 plants from coast to coast. Autolite also makes complete electrical systems for many makes of America's finest cars. All ignition engineered to fit together perfectly, work together perfectly, because they're a perfect team. The lifeline of your car. So, folks, don't accept electrical parts that are supposed to be as good. Remember, you're right with Autolite.
And now, back to our story.
Sergeant Barker, how do you know it was homicide?
Well, Mrs. Brown took careful pains to wash the soup pans and soup dishes before she served the rest of the meal.
Yes, I can see that.
But she forgot one thing, to wash the silver soup spoons. What she didn't realize was that an hour later, by the end of dinner, the spoon her husband had used to eat his toadstool soup would give her away. She didn't know that toadstools make silver turn black. Mrs. Brown almost committed the perfect murder, but she forgot to wash one spoon.
As little as was known about the program Darkness, which I just ran about half an hour ago, we know a lot more about the program X-1. It was considered the first and finest science fiction drama ever produced for radio. Although it wasn't really the first, that honor belongs to 2000+. It wasn't the second. That would be Dimension X. In fact, the first 15 episodes of X-1 are adaptations of programs from Dimension X. Not this one, though. This story is from September the 11th of 1956 and is a Robert Sheckley story. If you know Robert Sheckley, you're probably saying, oh, good, about now. Sheckley, particularly at this time, was a fine writer. And this is one of his AAA Ace Decontamination series stories. This isn't something they reference in the course of the play. I admit that X-1's shows could be kind of hit and miss. But this story holds up pretty well. And if you've never read any Robert Sheckley, you should find some and read some. Concentrating particularly on his collections of short stories that were mostly originally published in Galaxy magazine in the early to mid-50s. Look, I know that several of Sheckley's stories are in the public domain and are available as e-books from Gutenberg, and also that a number more have been produced for the LibriVox project of audiobooks. I will link to some of this on the webpage. Again, the webpage is www.nighttransmissions.com. It's this kind of thing that can make the website a fairly cool place to visit.
From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
The Lifeboat Mutiny by Robert Sheckley.
Of course, we should have known better. In a way, we were asking for it, but frankly, we were short of credits and beggars can't be choosers. As a rule, I don't like second-hand equipment, not if I have to trust my life to it. But Joe, the interstellar junk man, can be pretty persuasive. He has an air of confidence when he walks down between the rows of antique jalopies on his lot and pats an airlock door lovingly or kicks at the ground gyros to show how firm they are. Joe exudes faith the way trees drip sap in the spring. And if you get too close, a little rubs off on you.
Yeah, you see? Solid as a rock. Look at that plating. I'm telling you, this boat is a real buy.
She looks pretty old.
Sure, she's old.
Now, don't give us that story about it belonging to a little old lady who used it to flip to church on Sundays.
Now, look, boys, I'm not trying to unload something on you. I don't stand to make a nickel on this, but tell me the truth. Did you ever hear sweeter engines? And look at those servos.
Pretty old.
And that hull. I bet it's 500 years old and not a spot of corrosion on it. I'm telling you, you're lucky. It's a coincidence, you two fellas coming in. You need a lifeboat. And sitting right here waiting for you. Like you was made for each other. Is this baby?
Well, she certainly does seem rather nice. What do you think about it, Dick?
It does look pretty good. It's about what we need for the ocean survey work on Trident. But you know Joe.
Nah, they just don't build them this way anymore. Look at that propulsion unit. You couldn't dent it with a trip hammer. And note the capacity of the cooling system.
It looks good, but some of these old machines, you know, I just want to make absolutely sure it's safe.
Safe? Safe. He asked me if it's safe.
Is it?
Now, step inside. Go ahead. Step inside. All right. Push that button. Right there on the instrument panel.
This one?
Yeah.
I am Lifeboat 324A.
Hey, the darn thing talks.
Yeah, and in English, too.
It's equipped with a universal translator. It's completely automatic. I told you, they just don't build them this way anymore. Go ahead. Push the button again.
I am Lifeboat 324A. My primary purpose is to preserve those within me from peril and to maintain them in good health. At present, I am only partially activated.
Could anything be safer? This is no senseless hunk of metal. This boat will look after you. This boat cares.
I don't know. The idea of an emotional machine always gets me. I can't even stand those robot maitre d's. They keep slobbering over you every time you go into a restaurant with their tubes just pouring kindness and consideration.
Ah, you're a reactionary. We'll take it.
You won't be sorry. Boys, you just bought yourselves a lifeboat.
Joe delivered this assurance in the frank and open tones that had helped make him a millionaire several times over. It wasn't that he was dishonest. Far from it. All the flotsam he collected from anywhere in the universe worked. But ancient machines often had their own idea of how a job should be done. They tend to get peevish when forced into another routine.
Well, there she goes, Lifeboat 324A. I got her down in the afterhold. I think she's in perfect condition. You know, it's just what we need for those oceans on Trident.
I hope so. The last thing I bought from Joe was an electric razor. Only it turned out that it came from Deneb 3, where they are slightly reptilian. And an electric razor is used to help them change their skin in the hot months. If you remember, I was in the hospital 3 months, and after the skin grafts, I don't know my ears from my elbow. This job we were on was to survey the planet Trident for a real estate speculator who bought it for subdivision. Trident was about the size of Mars, but with a far better climate. There was no native indigenous population, no poisonous plants, and no germ-borne diseases. As a matter of fact, apart from one small island and one small polar ice cap, the entire planet was covered with water. There was no real shortage of land. You could wade across some of Trident's several seas. Our firm had been hired to survey and plan a little mountain raising because the sector council frowned on selling building lots under 4 feet of water. We landed on Trident and launched the lifeboat.
Okay, I got the sandwiches in the water. Ready to cast off?
Aye, aye, sir. All mooring lines are on board.
All right, let's crank this swan boat up and get going.
Well, push that button.
Aye, aye.
I am Lifeboat 324A. My primary purpose is to preserve those within me from peril and to maintain them in good health. At present, I am only partially activated. For full activity, press button 2.
Now there it is, right next to the first one.
Well?
Something's going on back there. Sounds like motors warming up. Hey, that sounds like a short circuit somewhere. You know there's no wheel on this thing?
Oh, wait a minute. There's got to be some kind of tiller or control.
Well, you look. That's all there are, 2 buttons.
Well, then maybe she controls telepathically.
I'll try it.
Hey, 324A, go ahead slowly.
Ah, there she goes. That's it.
Starboard a little.
Wait a minute. I still don't like the sound of that. I bet there's a short somewhere. I'm going down to look for it with a circuit tester.
Don't louse anything up. I like a boat that works this way. It gives me a sense of power.
Hey, 324A, full speed ahead.
Arnold disappeared into the bilge with a circuit tester, and I handled the survey. Actually, our machines did all the work, tracing the major faults in the ocean bottom, locating the most promising volcanoes. And when the survey was complete, the next stage would be turned over to the subcontractor. He would wire the volcanoes, seed the faults, and touch the whole thing off. After that, there'd be enough dry land on Trident for anybody. Now, by mid-afternoon, I figured we could knock off for a while. We ate our sandwiches, took a drink of water from the canteen, and then had ourselves a swim in Trident's clear, green water.
Hey, give me a hand up.
That was very refreshing.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to get this grease off with sandpaper, but I think I found the trouble. You see, the leads to the primary activator have been removed and the power cable's been cut.
Well, why would anyone do that?
Well, it might have been part of the decommissioning, but I got it hooked up now. Go ahead, hit the second button. Might as well have this thing working right.
Okay, here she goes.
I am Lifeboat 324A. I am now fully activated and able to protect my occupants from danger. Have faith in me. My action response tapes, both psychological and physical, have been prepared by the best scientific minds in all Drome.
Ah, that's more like it, huh? Gives you a feeling of confidence, doesn't it?
I suppose so. But where is Drome?
Oh. Gentlemen, try to think of me not as an unfeeling mechanism, but as your friend and comrade in arms. I understand how you feel. You have seen your ship go down, cruelly riddled by the implacable Hugen.
What ship? What's it talking about?
You have crawled aboard me, dazed, gasping from the poisonous fumes of water, half dead.
Oh, no, wait a minute. You mean that swim we took? You got it all wrong. We were just surveying.
Half dead, shocked, wounded, morale low. You were a little frightened, perhaps, and well, you might be, separated from the Drome fleet and adrift upon an alien planet. A little fear is nothing to be ashamed of, gentlemen. But this is war, and war is a cruel business, and we have no alternative but to drive the barbaric again across space.
There must be a reasonable explanation for all this.
Probably an old television script got mixed up in its response bank.
We better give it a complete overhaul. We can't listen to that stuff all day.
Well, we're about a quarter of a mile from the island. Ah, I tell you what. I'll take it down and clean the goo out of the contacts when we get there.
Hey. What's going on?
We're stopping. Hey, lifeboat.
Quiet. Calm. Trust in me. I am scanning the island.
What's he talking about, scanning me?
Better humor. Lifeboat, that island's okay. We checked it personally.
Perhaps you did. But in modern lightning-quick warfare, Drome senses cannot be trusted. They are too limited, too prone to interpret what they wish. Electronic senses, on the other hand, are emotionless, eternally vigilant, and infallible within their limits.
But there isn't anything there.
I perceive a foreign spaceship on the island.
Oh, that's our ship.
It has no Drome markings.
Well, it hasn't any enemy markings either. I painted it myself.
In war, we must assume that what is not ours is the enemy's.
Oh.
I understand your desire to set foot on land again, but I take into account factors that a Drome motivated by his emotions would overlook. Consider the apparent emptiness of the strategic bit of land, the unmarked spaceship put temptingly out for bait, the fact that our fleet is no longer in this vicinity.
All right, that's enough. Now, I'm tired of arguing with you. Go directly to that island. That's an order.
I cannot obey that order. You are unbalanced, from your harrowing escape from death.
All right, all right. Enough of this nonsense. I'm just going to take that cutoff switch and...
Come to your senses, gentlemen. Only the decommissioning officer is empowered to turn me off. For your own safety, I must warn you not to touch any of my controls. You are mentally unbalanced. Later, when our position is safer, I will administer to you. Now my full energies must be devoted towards detection and escape from the enemy.
Where are we going?
To rejoin the drone fleet as soon as I can find it.
We sailed over the empty seas of Trident for the rest of the afternoon and far into the night. At about midnight, we sat in the cabin sharing our last sandwich. The lifeboat was still rushing madly over the waves, its every electronic sense alert, searching for a fleet that had existed 500 years ago upon an entirely different planet.
Oh, why didn't I pack more sandwiches?
Did you ever hear of these drones?
Yeah, vaguely. They were non-human, lizard-evolved creatures. Mm. Yeah, they lived on the sixth planet of some little system near Capella. The race died out over a century ago.
Mm-hmm. And the Hagen. What about them?
Also lizards, same story. Mm. Wasn't a very important war, you know. All the combatants are gone except this lifeboat, apparently.
And us. We've been drafted as drone soldiery. Think we can reason with this, Tom?
Oh, no, I don't see how. As far as this boat is concerned, the war is still on. It can only interpret data in terms of that premise.
It's probably listening in on us now.
No, I don't think so. Hmm? See, it's not really a mind reader. Its perception senses are geared only to thoughts aimed specifically at it.
Yes, sirree. They just don't build them this way anymore. Ooh, I wish I could get my hands on Joe.
Well, you know, it's actually a very interesting situation. The machine is acting very logically upon no longer existent conditions. Therefore, you could say that the machine is the victim of a systematized delusion.
You mean the lifeboat is just plain insane?
Well, I believe paranoia would be the proper designation. Ah, but it'll end pretty soon.
Why?
It's obvious. The boat's prime objective is to keep us alive. Our sandwiches are gone, and the only other food is on the island. I figure it'll have to take a chance and go back.
Gentlemen, at present, I am unable to locate the drone fleet. Therefore, I am turning back to scan the island again. Fortunately, there are no enemies in this immediate area, so I can devote myself to your care.
Oh, you see, it's about time you got around to us. We're hungry.
Feed us.
Of course. Immediately. There you are. On the tray.
What's that?
That looks like clay.
Ooh, it smells like machine oil. Hey, what's it supposed to be?
That is giesel.
Hmm?
It's the staple diet of the drone people. I can prepare it in 16 different ways.
Oh, try it.
All right. It tastes like clay coated with machine oil. We can't eat that.
Of course you can. An adult drone consumes 5.3 pounds of giesel a day and cries for more.
Now listen, we are not drones. We are humans, an entirely different species. The war you think you're fighting ended 500 years ago. We can't eat giesel. Our food is on the island.
Ah, yes. Your delusion is a common one among fighting men. It is an escape fantasy, a retreat from an intolerable situation. Gentlemen, I beg you, face reality.
You face reality, or I'll have you dismantled bolt by bolt.
Threats do not disturb me. I know what you've been through. Possibly you've suffered some brain damage from your exposure to poisonous water.
Poisonous?
To drones.
If absolutely necessary, I am also equipped to perform physical brain therapy. It is a drastic measure, but there can be no coddling in time of war. You see? You need not worry. All my scalpels are razor sharp and ready for immediate action.
Oh, scalpels, huh? Well, we're feeling better already. That's a fine-looking batch of giesel, isn't it, Arnold?
Oh, delicious.
Nothing is too good for our boys in uniform.
Mmm.
Do try a little.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, that's delicious.
Good. I am moving toward the island now, and I promise you in a little while you will be more comfortable.
Why?
The temperature here is unbearably hot. It is amazing you haven't gone into a coma. Any other drone would have. Soon I'll have it down to drone norm of 20 degrees below zero. And now I'll play our national anthem.
Arnold?
What?
I'm cold.
Well, you should be very comfortable. Drones live at 20 below zero. We're drones and no back talk.
Those cooling tubes are all frosted up.
Yeah, I just wrote my name and frost in the porthole. Hey, wait a minute.
Hmm?
Wait a minute. I got an idea. Just follow my lead.
Why not? Lead on, fellow drone.
Give me the canteen.
What are you doing?
Just gonna get a little exercise. Gotta stay fit, you know.
That is true.
Here you are, boy. Catch!
Look out, that canteen's heavy.
Just throw it right back, boy. Just heave it right in. Come on, let's see your curve.
Be careful with that receptacle. It's filled with a deadly poison. Water.
Oh, we'll be careful. Here we go!
Bad shot, old man.
Oh, how careless of me. I seem to have broken the cooling tubes. Cooling fluid all over the floor.
I should have taken precaution against internal accidents. It won't happen again. But the situation is very serious. I cannot repair the cooling tube myself. I'm unable to properly cool the boat.
Say, that's tough. Now, if you'll just drop us on the island...
That is impossible. My first duty is to preserve your lives. And you couldn't live long in the climate of this planet. But I'm going to take necessary precautions to ensure your safety.
What are you going to do?
There is no time to waste. I will scan the island once more. If our drone forces are not present, we will go to the one place on the planet that can sustain drone life.
What place?
The southern polar ice cap. The climate there is almost ideal. 30 degrees below zero. And, of course, I must guard against any further internal accidents. So, I will lock you gentlemen in the cabin.
Think.
I am thinking. Nothing's coming out.
We've got to get off when he reaches the island. It'll be our last chance.
Now, look. We know his internal scanning isn't very good. When we reach the island, maybe we could cut his power cable.
Oh, you couldn't get within 5 feet of it. He's got an electric charge on all the controls.
I am now scanning the island.
Place looks fine today.
Oh, sure does. I'll bet our forces are dug in underground.
They are not. I scan to a depth of 100 feet.
Well, under the circumstances, I think we should examine it a little more carefully.
It is deserted. I cannot let you endanger your lives by going ashore. Drome needs her soldiers, especially sturdy, heat-resistant types like you.
We like this climate.
Spoken like a patriot. I know you must be suffering, but now I am going to the South Pole to give you veterans the rest you deserve.
Wait a minute. You don't understand. We're operating under special orders. We weren't supposed to disclose them to any vessel below the rank of Super Dreadnought. We're a suicide squad.
Yes, yes, that's right. Especially trained for hot climate war.
Our orders are to land and secure that island for the drone forces.
I didn't know that.
You weren't supposed to. After all, you're only a lifeboat.
Land us at once.
I couldn't guess, you know. All right. We'll head for the island.
Arnold, it's going to work.
Why not, as long as we tell him the truth?
The beach is only 50 yards away.
No.
No what?
I cannot do it.
What do you mean? This is war. Orders.
I know, but I cannot obey. A different type of vessel should have been chosen for this mission, but not a lifeboat.
You must think of our country. Think of the barbaric Hagen.
It is electronically impossible for me to carry out your orders. My prime directive is to protect my occupants from harm. That order is stamped on my every tape, giving priority above all others. I cannot let you go to your certain death.
You'll be court-martialed for this. I'll have you broken down to a dinghy.
I regret to say I must operate within my limitations. I must take you to the safety of the South Pole.
Listen, you crazy tin can. Let me at those controls. I'll...
Please, do not attempt any more destruction. I know how you feel.
Wait a minute,
but...
Arnold, old friend. Since we cannot accomplish our mission, we cannot ever again face our comrades. Death before dishonor. Hand me the canteen.
No. Don't. That's water. It is a deadly poison. Don't. Don't.
Too late. Arnold, it's your turn.
We, who are about to die, salute you. We die for glorious Drome. That goes for me, too.
Speak to me. Speak to me.
Lie still, you idiot.
There is no known antidote. If only I could contact the hospital ship. Speak to me. Are you still alive? Answer me. Here. Here. Perhaps if you eat some geisel. Dead. 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 I will now read the burial service. Great Spirit of the universe, take into your custody the souls of these your servants. Although they died by their own hand, still it was in the service of their country, fighting for home and hearth. Judge them not harshly for their impious deed. Rather, blame the spirit of war that inflames and destroys the spirit of all Drome. And now, by the authority vested in me, by the Drome fleet, and with all reverence, I commend their bodies to the deep.
Ow!
Shut up.
Accept them, O ocean, for many brave hearts are at slumber in the deep.
Float quietly.
What's the lifeboat doing? It's still hanging around.
Just pray the Drones didn't believe in cremation.
Sleep quietly, brave spirits. I will now play the Drome national anthem.
Well, there she goes.
Where?
To the South Pole. To wait for the Drome fleet.
You have just heard X-1 presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features The Man Who Ate the World by Frederick Pohl. This is the story of a civilization which flowed with milk and honey, and of a man whose tragedy was that he had not drowned at birth. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight by transcription, X-1 has brought you The Lifeboat Mutiny, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Robert Sheckley and adapted for radio by Ernest Kenoy. Featured in the cast were Leon Janney, Mandel Kramer, William Redfield, and John McGovern. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Okay, one last break here, and then we'll be right back. Next I have for you another one of those shows in old-time radio for which almost nothing has survived. It's called The Haunting Hour, although it should have been called The Haunting Half Hour, because that's how long it is. It's a half-hour program, and it's called A Corpse There Was. The Haunting Hour must have been made for syndication. And now, like so many old-time radio programs, there's really no information left that I can find. Not unlike the program Darkness. This is a show without a history. Darkness, I at least had some idea when it was made. But there exist no tracks that I have found for this show. I don't know when it was made. I don't know who made it. I don't know who produced it. I don't know who starred in it, or who did the music, or anything.
No. No, stay where you are. Do not break the stillness of this moment. For this is a time of mystery. A time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is The Haunting Hour. A corpse there was.
Will you listen to me? I've got to tell it to someone, and, well, I guess you've heard a lot of strange stories. I'm Catherine Holland. It all started about a year after I'd come to work for Martin Reed and Stephen Corey as the housekeeper. Oh, we'd have such fun, the three of us. Martin was forever making me promise that I'd be with them always. Always. I didn't know how long that could be.
You're only joking, huh, Kathy? You wouldn't leave us. You'll stay with us always, won't you?
Not if you keep doing that, Martin.
Oh, you'll get used to it, Kathy.
Oh, but cutting your own name on a tombstone, it's positively morbid.
I don't see that. If a cobbler can make his own shoes, then surely a stone cutter can make his own monument.
Well, that's true.
After all, a man must do something with his spare time. And you, Stephen, of all people, have no right to scoff at me. Imagine a cemetery caretaker who wanders through the graveyard day and night talking to the dead.
If the people I met outside the cemetery, my dear Martin, were as interesting as the people I meet inside, perhaps I wouldn't. Since there are only neighbors along this godforsaken road, and since I must get away from you occasionally...
Now, look here, enough is enough.
Are we going to let her boss us around, Martin? You nearly 60 and me twice her age?
That's right. And you're 42, aren't you, Steve?
Yep.
You know, I think for your next birthday, I'll start on a nice marble headstone for you.
Okay, I quit. I resign.
Oh, no, don't say that, Kathy. We need you, Stephen and I. Always before, our housekeepers were stout and rheumatic. You're so young. It was like all at once having the shades pulled up and the windows opened when you came. You won't leave us, will you, Kathy?
No, I won't leave you, Martin.
You promise?
I do. If you promise to take your medicine.
No, I told you, Kathy. I don't believe in that quack doctor. There's nothing wrong with my heart.
Oh, Martin, don't be stubborn.
It's not a matter of being stubborn. I know I'm perfectly all right.
How about those attacks you've had?
Well, they were indigestion.
You don't want to take that medicine because you and the doc have been enemies for years. You won't give him the satisfaction of treating you, even if it means...
Please, Kathy. Don't you think I'm old enough to know my own mind?
But Kathy's right, Martin. You should take your medicine.
Oh, now you start. I'm going for a walk.
I'll go with you.
I don't want company.
Now he's mad.
Oh, don't take it to heart. He'll get over it.
I wish he hadn't gone out in this weather.
Yeah. I think it's getting worse. I'll go call him back.
Stephen, what's that noise?
I don't know. But just outside the house. It's our cedar tree. That last flash of lightning struck it. There seems to be... Kathy!
What? Move away from the door so I can see Tuesday.
No, Kathy, please. Stay in here a minute. I'll go out.
Well, I'll go with you.
I see something beside the cedar. Come on, Kathy.
Stephen, can't we?
Yes, Kathy. It's Martin. He's dead.
The tree?
It didn't touch him. He died from the shock of it falling so close. It was heartbreaking.
Strange, isn't it? The last tombstone he ever carved was his own. Martin the next evening. There weren't many mourners. We lived too far from town to be well acquainted. At last, the few who'd come went away and left Stephen and me alone at the grave. They've all gone.
Your eyes are all red, Kathy.
Do you suppose he likes where we buried him? Right across the road from the house?
I'm sure he does. He can sort of watches from here if he gets lonely.
It won't be us much longer, Stephen.
What do you mean?
Well, I can't stay here with just you. It isn't proper.
Kathy, you know I wouldn't...
Oh, I know, but what'll people think?
I don't care about people. They're not important.
Well, they are to me. I have a good reputation, Stephen, and I don't...
Kathy, don't leave me.
Oh, but I must.
Losing Martin was unbearable, but if I lost you, I'd have nothing left.
I'm sorry, Stephen.
There'd be no one to care if I live or die. If you go, I'll be all alone.
You'll find another housekeeper.
Housekeeper? Oh, Kathy, dearest, don't be such a little fool.
I'm not a fool.
You are if you can't see how much I love you.
You love me? Oh, no.
How could I help it? You're sweet and fresh and lovely. And I never knew before what joy it was to watch a woman. Anything you do, the way you walk and laugh, even the way you get angry. It's beautiful.
Oh, keep away from me. I don't know what's come over you.
I was content just having you about the house, being near you. But now... Oh, my darling, you mustn't go away.
Oh, please don't look at me like that. Please, Stephen.
Dearest, let's get married. I'll make you happy.
No, I don't love you. Don't touch me. Oh, I like you a lot. I'm very fond of you, but... Well, it's not love. I could never love you.
Why, Kathy? I'll make you a good husband.
Oh, no, Stephen, no. You're twice my age.
But I'd worship you, Kathy, dearest.
Oh, will you quit bawling Kathy, dearest, at me like a lost lamb? I'm going to the house and pack my things.
I won't let you go. You belong to me.
I don't belong to anyone. If you don't get out of my way, I'll throw this rock at you.
There's someone else. You love someone else.
No, no, Stephen, I just don't love you. Don't come near me, I'll throw it, I swear.
Kathy, no!
I told you I would, didn't I? Why couldn't you believe me? Well, get up. Stephen. He was lying on his back, motionless. I bent over him and... His face! The rock had caught him between the eyes. I couldn't think. I was terrified. I only knew that Stephen was dead. That I had killed him. A murderess, that's what everybody would say. They put me on trial, all those faces gaping at me like I wasn't human. And then they... No! I had to get out of here. The road past the graveyard. If I followed it, I'd reach the main highway. I'd run. I'd run so fast, no one would catch me. It would be dark. The body wouldn't be found till morning. By then, I'd be far away. I had to keep moving. I had to. Where could I go? Where could I hide? Flying down the road for hours. hours and hours till my legs were numb and my heart tearing and my chest deafening me with its thunder. No, that wasn't my heart. It was a car. They were looking for me. Somehow they'd found Stephen already. Oh, it was getting nearer and nearer. I slipped behind a tree. Picnickers. Oh, the only ones who might have seen me. They'll forget they even passed this way once they're safe at home. Safe at home. Suddenly I realized what a fool I'd been. I couldn't escape a police dragnet by running away. They'd never stop looking for me. The best place to hide was at home. Why, of course. I'd gone back to the house from the funeral and straight to bed. Stephen had decided to stay at the grave a while longer. Everyone in town knew he liked to wander through the cemetery. And especially tonight, with Martin just buried. He must have caught a prowler, and the man had thrown a rock at him. That's how it happened. I felt perfectly calm. I turned around and started back. The sky had been cloudy all evening, but as I walked up the road toward home, it cleared. I remember how lovely the moonlight looked, spilling down the steps of the house. I started to climb them. Suddenly, I had an impelling desire to see Stephen's body. Well, I tried to fight it, but the thought of him, cold and crumpled, lying like some cast-off doll in an attic, hypnotized me. I went down the stairs and started across the road. He had been lying at the foot of Martin's grave, I remembered. From where I was, I couldn't make out the body. Oh, that wasn't right. The old man was buried directly across from the house. I should be able to see Stephen. I slipped through the gate. Hurried to where the corpse had lain. It was gone. There wasn't a trace of it. I dropped to my hands and knees, searching about the new mound of earth for some proof that it hadn't all been a nightmare, that I'd really killed Stephen. There wasn't anything. No matted grass where the blood should have dried. Nothing fallen from his pockets. Not even the stone with which I'd struck him. And it was so quiet. So deathly quiet. With the moon whitewashing Martin's headstone, and the one next to it. The one next to it. But there hadn't been any grave there before. And this one was fresh. As fresh as Martin's. I slowly raised my eyes and looked at the tombstone.
Stephen Corey. Born May 9th, 1901. Died April 20th, 1944.
Why, I'd know that carving anywhere. Martin was dead. But Martin had made that gravestone.
Kathy stands in the moonlight, staring. staring at the grave plaque of Stephen Corey, a plaque identical with the one Martin had made for himself before he died.
And yet, how could Martin have carved that headstone? He had not made one for Stephen before he died. I knew that. Still, Stephen had been buried, and the date on the monument was right. Oh, I felt the answer, but I pushed it back away from my mind. It couldn't be true that Martin had kept his promise even now and had carved the stone. That these dead who were Stephen's friends had buried him. Had he loved me so, he wouldn't make me pay for what I'd done. Did he plead with them to cover him so I'd not be found out? I didn't know. I was paralyzed with fright. I had to get out of here back to the house before I lost my sanity. I don't know how long I lay there, cowering in my bed. At last, the darkness of the night closed in about me, and I slept. But then, out of the darkness, the doorbell rang. Sharp sound, a streak of fear over my flesh. The police had come. Stephen's grave had been discovered. I had to go to the door.
Are you Catherine Holland? I'm Estelle Bailey, Martin's sister.
Oh, yes, I should have known. Come in, Mrs. Bailey.
Stephen sent me a telegram this afternoon about Martin's death, and I took the first train out here. I'm sorry if I woke you.
Oh, that's quite all right. Come in. I know it's been a long trip. Perhaps I can fix you a bite to eat.
No, thank you. I'd like you to take me to see the grave right away.
Martin's grave? Now?
Miss Holland, I hadn't seen Martin for 9 years. I'm ashamed of that, and I want to rectify it now as soon as I can. If you won't take me, perhaps Mr. Corey will.
Oh, he's not here. He's in town.
Well, I'll wait up till he comes in.
Oh, you'll wait a long time.
I don't understand.
Oh, Stephen was quite shocked by your brother's death, you know, and, well, he felt he had to get away from this house, so, well, he mightn't be back tonight.
But if he went into town, why didn't he meet me at the station as he wrote he would?
Well, I don't know. Every moment she sat there, she'd think more and more about Stephen's absence. I had to distract her the only way I could. I had to take the chance that she wouldn't notice that other headstone. But if she did notice it, I would have to kill her, too. But just then, something happened to spare us both.
Oh, good heavens! Oh, look, it's raining again.
Yes, the moon's gone in. It's pitch black outside.
Then there's no use going into the cemetery, I suppose.
I'm afraid not, Mrs. Bailey. What a shame. Finally, she went upstairs. I waited until I knew she slept. Then I took a spade and crept across to the cemetery. It was wet and cold, but I didn't notice the weather. For I had a scheme. A very clever scheme. I was going to dig up someone else's headstone as well as Stephen's and switch the two. I couldn't disguise his new-made grave, but at least I'd conceal who was buried there. It was just before dawn when I slipped back to the house. Mrs. Bailey woke me about 8, and together we went to the cemetery. I came up level with the graves and... Oh, no. No, it couldn't be. Well, I switched them last night.
Stephen Corey, born May 9th, 1901. Died April 20th, 1944.
His headstone. Exactly where it had been before. But I had dug it up. There were blisters on my hands to prove it. Mrs. Bailey, had she noticed? No. She'd gone right to her brother's grave and stood staring at it, wiping away the tears.
I'm very glad of one thing, Miss Holland, that Martin is buried a little apart from everyone else. He liked to be alone most of the time, you know. Even in death, he would prefer solitude and being isolated from all the others.
Solitude? isolated from all the others. But Stephen was lying right by his side. She couldn't see Stephen's headstone. It was incredible, but it was true.
Come, Miss Holland, it's raining. We might as well go now. I'll take the early train back to the city.
After she'd gone, the house was empty, yet full of a screaming silence. And I sat looking out at the grayness of the lonesome day. Had there really been a grave at all? Growing inside me with a grim fascination to see. The mud sucked at my shoes. Through the dusk, I walked determinedly toward that spot where the headstone stood. I slipped to the fence. Then I was standing beside the tree, leaning against it. For I couldn't believe what I saw. There, beside the others, stood a third headstone. And stretching almost at my feet, a freshly dug grave. Even before I crept forward to see, I knew what the plaque would say.
Catherine Holland, born June 7th, 1923, dead April 21st, 1945.
Tonight? April 21st? That was tonight. And I was still alive. Martin, listen to me wherever you are. I said I'd be with you always, but you can't force me to follow you. You can't force me to follow you. Tears filled my eyes. I took hold of the hateful stone and tried to flatten it into the ground. Then through the tears, I saw the dark bruises on my hands. Bruises on my hands, but, well, it wasn't possible that... I touched one of the dark splotches. It rubbed away. Then the truth went through my mind. I fell to my knees. The letters I thought were carved into the stone. They too were blurred. I drew my finger along my name. It was lettered in black crayon. Thick, archaic lettering. Darker toward the middle than at the edges. Giving the illusion of depth. Giving the illusion of being cut into the stone. Then that's how Stephen's headstone was made. That's how. I stood up. Fear fell over me like a cold, wet sheet. Behind this adventure was a human being. A being like myself. Then I saw the thing in the grass, sending a tiny sparkle toward the dust-filled sky, and greedily I picked it up. A copper-colored metal cap from an eyebrow pencil. So that was how the letters had been drawn. That was how this thing had happened. Then I knew who had done it. And even before I turned to look, I knew she was standing there, staring at me, unmoving, a thin smile on her lips, her eyebrows thin too, penciled on with surety and deftness.
Turn around, Miss Holland. I see you have guessed the truth.
It was you. You killed him.
But do you think my conscience will hurt me as yours does? Would it make your death any easier to know you didn't kill Stephen Corey?
I don't understand you.
I'm telling you the truth. I came into the cemetery just as the last visitor left, and I saw you throw the rock at Corey. I saw you run for the road. You hadn't killed him, Miss Holland. He was only unconscious. But I made sure he was dead before I buried him.
Then you dug the grave here. That spade in your hand.
Will serve a double purpose. I shall kill you with it.
Just as you murdered Corey. Why? Why did you kill him?
Because Martin had willed all the family property to Corey, with the provision that when he died, it would return to me. I knew if his body weren't discovered, they'd think you and he had run away together. Then I'd have to wait for him to be declared legally dead.
And so you put up the plaque.
I felt sure I could persuade the county coroner to file a death certificate quietly. Then I'd show my lawyer the grave, show him that Corey, too, was dead. But you came back, so I have to kill you, too. Now you know the truth. Your time has come.
That spade, Mrs. Bailey.
Is for you, Miss Holland.
Stay back from me. Stay back.
I'm going to kill you.
I'm not afraid, Mrs. Bailey. You're real. I can fight you.
This will be your grave, and I shall bury you in it.
Give me that spade. Give it to me. Go here. I said that spade. Mrs. Bailey. My eyes were crowded with flashes of blackness. I lay on the ground, feeling the cold, wet earth against my cheek. Without warning, it had happened. One wall of the grave gave way, and she lost her balance and fell forward into the gaping hole. Dirt from the mound began rolling down, clods of it covering the edges of her long skirt. And she lay still, silenced, at the bottom of the grave. A few wet clods of earth were still slowly tumbling down, as if they had an intelligence of their own. An intelligence that told them to bury the dead. Bury the dead. For she was dead. And she had died instantly. Her neck twisted beneath her loosened, flowing hair that hid the hideous sight of her eyebrows, thin and long. Her neck was broken, and she lay in the grave she had meant for me. Perhaps, now I've told it, I can forget the horror of what's happened. But not soon. Not soon. One way Martin was right. In my brain, he and Stephen will be with me always.
Shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubts and fears. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory in the haunting hour.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the internet. And there's a good deal of ancillary material there. More details about the shows. And even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.